others, and we'll hear from Ms. Fournet.
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the court. I represent Ava McElwee in this matter. I will not belabor the record too much, except to say that there is, in the case of Ava McElwee in particular, a single thread that runs through this appeal that we would submit drives the rulings on a number of issues, most particularly but not exclusively the sentence that was imposed in this case, and that was her marriage, her marital relationship with Dr. Tandy McElwee, a physician, and we would submit a much more culpable party in the conduct that took place in this case. This case raises issues that are somewhat novel regarding unwarranted assumptions that result in holding a spouse responsible for what the other spouse does. And those assumptions infect this entire record, again, especially but not exclusively.
Are you claiming she was completely innocent and had no knowledge of anything that was going on?
Well, I've also raised a sufficiency of the evidence claim, Your Honor, so yes. But I will assume for the purpose of this argument that the jury, without conceding, that the jury legitimately convicted her of the two counts of which she was convicted.
So what is your argument now that I thought you were kind of arguing the innocent spouse or something? What is your argument?
Well, it's an awkward
position.
You're
arguing that the sentence is excessive? Is that what you're...
I'm arguing that even if the convictions were legitimate, which I do not concede, the sentence was way out of bounds and was unreasonable and was an abuse of discretion. I want to be very careful about how I hold my mouth. Sometimes we have to hold our mouth two ways when we're on appeal, because I have raised this sufficiency claim as well. But even assuming those were valid convictions without conceding that, the sentence was way, way, way out of bounds. And in fact, her marriage to this man, I would submit to the court, was used to astronomically and, in my view, artificially inflate what the record shows was at best a very peripheral role in what was occurring in her husband's office. And these assumptions and this skewed view of the record affected virtually every ruling on
it. I mean, she had an opportunity to put a stop to it when the Walmart people called and she said, well, don't fill that prescription, but she didn't do anything to put a stop to what was going on other than just to say not to fill that one.
Well, she did say not to fill that one, and I guess you could spin it two ways. The government spun it as this was part of an effort by her to participate in not causing any problems for the office. But the other way to spin it is she didn't know the magnitude, and this would certainly be my interpretation of the record. Your Honor, to me, the fact that she told Walmart not to fill any more prescriptions is an indication not that she was aware, but that she was unaware of the magnitude of wrongdoing in that office, and that she took it upon herself and took the responsibility to tell Walmart not to fill what she thought was suspicious.
Okay, but I mean, as far as the spin you put on facts, I mean, that's not for us to do here.
Well, I understand that.
I mean, the trial judge heard the trial, considered the PSR, considered the arguments, and made a determination that Wendy Criss, who accepted responsibility and pled guilty and didn't put the government to a trial, was less culpable, and Dr. Tandy McElwee, who, as you say, is at the top of this whole heap, is more culpable, and he put her in the middle. I mean, why isn't that an ordinary discretionary call that I might have made differently, you might have made differently, but the judge is the one with the discretion.
Well, and perhaps spin was not the right choice of words. The truth is, Your Honors, there is simply no evidence that this lady knew of the volume or magnitude of wrongdoing in that office, and there's considerable evidence that she didn't. Now, in terms of ranking...
Like what? What is the evidence that she didn't?
She reprimanded one of the employees for giving hydrocodone to one of the employees' hairdressers. But, I mean, I can give you
a reprimand? I mean, that's a Schedule III drug just being handed out to get your hair colored to your hairdresser, and you just say, hey, don't do that? I mean, that's pretty darn serious behavior. She's a nurse practitioner. She knows that's not right. She's not some unknowing, you know, duped spouse who's unaware of these kinds of things. She knows what that drug is and what the restrictions are on its use and provision. And I think that shows she is aware and she's not doing what she can.
That shows she was aware of isolated instances, and that also shows that when she became aware of isolated instances, she intervened. Now,
But how do you explain the fact that she signed for many of these prescriptions?
Well, she signed prescriptions routinely. She picked up and signed prescriptions routinely.
Some of which were to herself, and you say she didn't have any reason for it, except on two occasions the record supports that she had some medical need, and she signed other prescriptions for herself in her own name.
Well, she would go and she would pick up a number of prescriptions, and yes, some of them were for her. And some of those that were for her were legitimate non-CDS prescriptions. Her husband admitted, and this is very, very common with substance abusers, that he used her name without her knowledge and without her consent to order prescriptions.
But if she's picking up a prescription in her own name and signing for it, and she knows that she doesn't need it, then how can she be innocent or be unknowing that prescriptions are going out in her name for drugs that are not for her?
Well, there are two things going on there. One is that the record keeping in the office was very, very bad.
But I don't see how that answers. If I go to a drugstore and they're handing me 50 pills of hydrocodone and I'm in my name for me, and I'm signing my name for them, and I know they're not for me, how does that mean I don't know what's going on?
Well, Judge, that may make sense for you going up and picking prescriptions up for yourself, but this was a lady that worked at a doctor's office and who would go to the pharmacy and who would pick up lots of prescriptions for lots of different people, including herself, and sign for them. Now, maybe she should have sat down and examined every single prescription. Obviously, she didn't. That's a long way from criminal conduct. The record does not show one single instance of her calling in or faxing fraudulent prescriptions, or of her using a false name to obtain a prescription. All of that was done.
What about the evidence that she doctored the record for her daughter-in-law, who never had the treatment that was reflected in the medical record?
Well, that's a very confusing issue. Because the witness who testified about the doctoring of the records testified that Wendy Criss, who really was the engine behind all of this, including but not limited to the doctoring of the records, and another employee doctored the records, and that Ava McElwee was not involved, and that was testified to several times. There was a suggestion by the government that perhaps The records were doctored before the subpoena was issued that triggered this activity. But it's never made clear why anyone, Ava McAwee or anyone else, would doctor records just for no particular reason. What really troubled me about that one piece of evidence is that the government never called a handwriting expert even to testify that this was Ava McAwee's handwriting in the first place. She had two lay witnesses.
You have some time for rebuttal. I believe your red light is on. And
I'd like to save my time for rebuttal. Okay. Thank you, Your Honor.
You can certainly bring up those issues then. Mr. Harlow?
Yes, Your Honor.
Representing
Wendy Chris. Yes, Your Honor.
Is she currently serving her sentence?
She is now at a halfway house, Your Honor. She's a couple of months away from being released and beginning supervised release.
Okay.
May it please the court, counsel. Douglas Lee.
Practically speaking, can you do much for her? I mean, if we were to remand and so forth, by the time it was considered, would she really get any effect on her sentence?
I believe that this court has had similar cases that where a sentence has been served by the time this court gets the case and that it's found that the issue is not moot, that you can affect the supervised release term. In this case, she is still subject to 3 years of supervised release.
Because I didn't really see much of a challenge to the supervised release. It seemed to me you were challenging the 21 months, but that's fair. If that's what you're challenging, is the supervised release.
Well, at this point in time, it would have to be, Your Honor, because realistically, by the time Your Honor's considered this case with the three defendants, an opinion issues, the time for argument, rehearing, an appeal passes, it would be a supervised release issue. And I think that you could address the improper length of sentence if you do find that by remanding it to the district court to shorten that period of supervised release. I think that would be an equitable issue, and it would hit the heart of this case. If you look at the reasons for 3553 and reasons for sentencing.
Actually, does it? I mean, her whole claim is, look, I learned from this. I'm on the straight and narrow. I want to be a good wife and mother. And actually, supervised release would help her with that.
It would and it wouldn't. It would impose certain limits on her, as with any supervised release. Dropping or shortening the period of supervised release would do would be to begin to allow her to leave the criminal justice system, to not have to report to the courts, to not have to have her life monitored, which would be fair in this particular case.
Well, my problem with your case, sir, is that, I mean, she got a guideline sentence with credit for acceptance of responsibility, and she was so involved in this up to her eyeballs. I just have a problem with her argument that the sentence was unreasonable.
There is definitely involvement in this case, and that it complicates the argument. But I think if you look at it at this, and as I was preparing, if you look at the eight people involved in this conspiracy, three of them received jail sentences, the others received probation. Where does she fit in this? Where does Ms. Chris fit in this? At the time that this crime took place, a crime which she is not denying she was involved in, at the time it took place, you had Tandy McAwee, who was a doctor. You had his wife, who is a nurse practitioner. You had the third level down, a licensed practical nurse, Susan Hotard, who received probation. You have a drug representative who, according to the evidence at trial, leaked information from the State Board of Medical Examiner's investigation to the group, which allowed the doctoring of records allegedly to begin.
Yeah, but wasn't it your client who did the doctoring?
She did do some, but again, if you look at the other people who got probation, even according to the government's brief, Wendy Chris, Brannon, Hotard, Cockrell, all were involved in the altering of medical records. What was an appropriate sentence for those? Brannon, Hotard, and Cockrell got probation. Wendy Chris certainly had another role and a higher role in this, but she served 21 months in, well, she will have ended up serving 21 months in imprisonment. She's certainly been punished appropriately for that. And if you look at 3553, has she been deterred? Yes. Has someone seen that you cannot simply do what she did and then walk out a door? Yes, she has. She's been punished. It meets the deterrence. It meets the punishment. Her sentence that she's already served shows this is a serious crime. We are not going to let you get away with this. You have to accept responsibility. And she did that. What ending the term of supervised release would do for her is would reward people and encourage people to do exactly what she did. Don't put the government to its burden of going to trial. Don't make the government prove a case that is clearly proven.
Judge Pan said she got the 2 points for acceptance responsibility. She got the low end of the guideline sentence. I mean, she got credit, if you will, for coming forward. She didn't get the upward variance that the McElwees got.
Certainly, and it does address the differences in these defendants and their differences in culpabilities. I just think that if you look at what these people's roles were, what their professional affiliations were, she is either if not entitled to a minor participant role, she's very close. This is a woman who would have had the 2-point reduction in sentence under the safety valve, except for the government and the judge did not think that she was being cooperative. But she met all the other guidelines.
But that's a big exception because she didn't truthfully debrief.
That is something that we are not conceding. She says that she did. If you look at one of the big issue here is Mr. Jacoby, who testified that she gave him prescription medication. That came at trial. What you're doing here is punishing someone who did not have their lawyer there at trial to effectively cross-examine Mr. Jacoby because she had done what you want to encourage people to do.
I think it's pretty telling that you have somebody who's at the center of this whole elaborate mess, and no one wants to call her as a witness. She pleads guilty, can be called as a witness, and no one wants to call her because no one believes her. Both sides. I mean, right. When both sides agree on something that important, I kind of think that's something the judge can take into account.
It certainly is something the judge can take into account, but you have someone here, and that's not a requirement for the safety valve that people believe you. It's that you tell what you know.
Yes, whether you're telling the truth is, in fact, a piece of the fifth part prong of the safety valve. Absolutely. And how does one judge credibility? A lot of different ways. She's been contradicted by a witness. Nobody wanted to call her because they didn't believe her. I mean, those are things I think the trial judge can consider on deciding whether she truthfully debriefed.
The only thing that I agree with 90% of what you're saying. I have some issue, though, with judging someone's credibility on the fact that other people didn't call them. You don't know if she had information on the McElwees that would have hurt the McElwees. Is that why they didn't call her? The court says no one called her, but there were only 3 people. There was the government and there were the McElwees. And you don't know why those trial counsel for the McElwees did not call her.
The judge said it was because they didn't believe her. I mean, so I don't know.
Right, and that's a finding by the judge, but it's just not something that can be supported by the record. And I know there's a good reason for you not to let us prevail on issue number 1 or number 2, but I think this is a case for issue number 3. When I think they're close and there are valid arguments on issues 1 and 2. I think when you look at this, with this defendant and the time she served, the equitable thing to do, the fair thing to do, and the reasonable thing to do would be to sentence her to less time. You do that here by allowing her to come off supervised release earlier.
Thank you, Mr. Harlan.
Thank you, Your Honors.
Mr. Stroud, representing Dr. McElwee.
Good morning. I represent Dr. McElwee, and our argument focuses solely on the sentence that was imposed in this matter and the procedure that the judge undertook, Judge Hicks undertook in arriving at a sentence, a 60-month sentence of confinement and a fine of $550,000. I will acknowledge I let my civil law, or what I thought civil law background, interfere with my understanding of joint and several. I concede the government's issue on that point. Dr. McElwee is individually responsible for $550,000 as opposed to the nearly $1 million that I suggested in my opening brief, and I apologize to the court for that. The government indicates that, first of all, that we did not sufficiently object to the sentence that was imposed in this matter. I take exception to that. There were 3 objections imposed. The last objection made, the judge finished the sentence. And when the judge finished the sentence, I thought that was sufficient, number one. Number two, it never occurred to me.
Sufficient to do what?
Ma'am?
Sufficient to do what?
Sufficient to protect my, to note my objection to the sentence that had just been imposed. I stated, I note my objection, and the court interrupted and said, objection noted and made general. I don't know what else I could have done.
Well, because after that, though, I mean, it wasn't like then he said, okay, call the next case. You had this long colloquy about where Dr. McElwee would go and whether he would get 500 hours of drug therapy and so on, and you never once said a word about the alleged excessiveness of the fine. I mean, that just was not discussed at all. So I'm just questioning. I know the judge knew you had some problems with the sentence because you just spent 48 pages talking about that. But how was the judge advised that you had a problem with the fine?
We had argued about it for 48 minutes. When a judge tells me your objection is noted, I think, as a practical matter, I find that to be sufficient.
Okay, so you feel like you had argued about the fine already.
I had not argued about the fine already. The first time I had any notice of the fine is when the amount of the fine that he was going to impose was when he imposed it.
Right, so then how could he know that you were objecting to that when you haven't? You've spent 48 pages talking about the case. But then he, in your view, startles you with this fine that you think is way over the top, and all you do is let him say you have a general objection to the sentence?
Judge, he interrupted me, and when a judge interrupts me, the judge prevails. I don't want to get into an unnecessary argument
counsel,
with the trial judge.
I appreciate that. However, it wasn't like he interrupted you and then shut you down and moved on to the next case, in which case I could see the problem of coming back and making a jerk out of yourself. But here you had three or four more pages of this long colloquy about where Dr. McElwee is going to go. In the midst of that, you could have said, Judge, I'm not sure I made clear. I'm also objecting to the fine as excessive. And I don't think he would have been thrown out of court for that.
I don't think saying I object to the fine is a magical word. I think when an objection is made to a sentence that imposes a fine that exceeds the statutory maximum by almost seven times that
exceeds the statutory maximum?
No, ma'am, excuse me, suggested guideline maximum.
Okay.
I was in error. I feel that I made an appropriate objection. I don't know what else I could have said. The judge noted the objection. I went into that sentencing, and this is, I guess, the gravamen of my argument. I went into that sentencing with a pre-sentence report in which the probation officer specifically said, there are no factors to warrant either an upward or downward departure in this case. That's in the pre-sentence report. The judge in his sentencing said,
But a departure is different from a non-guideline sentence. Would you concede that?
Well, there was no indication in the pre-sentence report that there was going to be a non-guideline sentence. I walked in there into court with a PSR and two addendums, and had said nothing about the fine to be imposed other than the general statement that the defendant could afford a fine.
Is it your contention that you were statutorily entitled to notice?
It's not my intention to suggest that, but it is my intention to say that as a matter of fundamental fairness, and if you look at I cite the case of U.S. versus Fair, where it says if the judge accepts the pre-sentence report, the findings and the factual recommendations of the pre-sentence report, and then deviate from the fine, the judge needs to signify or state the basis for this upward departure. I had no notice of this. It came out of the blue.
I don't understand why the judge's specific statements justifying the upward departure on the prison sentence and the fact that the pre-sentence investigation report says that your client is going to get $16,000 a month till he dies, which is $192,000 a year. He's got a positive net worth, and he's only got $150,000 in debt, which in these days is not that much. I don't understand, and the fine is supposed to be punitive, why the judge's overall statement of reasons justifying the prison sentence, plus the fact that the PSR clearly set out, and he had other assets, because there was an issue raised about disposition of assets at the conclusion of the sentencing hearing, why all of that in toto does not make the fine determination on a variance reasonable under the standards that the courts apply to discretionary sentencing.
Well, first of all, Your Honor, the judge well, he didn't give us an opportunity to address that. There was no finding that he had an ability to pay the fine. The figures you cite are in the pre-sentence report, but these were disability benefits. The pre-sentence report said he had a cash flow of $5,000-something dollars a month, which since the pre-sentence report, at the time of the pre-sentence, it went from $22,000 down to $16,000. He had expenses such as paying for insurance, household expenses, et cetera, et cetera.
Yeah, but he's going to be in jail for 5 years. He's not going to have those expenses. Well, so I think the judge could consider that these disability payments he's getting can go towards his maintenance in the prison. I'm sorry, your time's up.
No, well, go ahead, and you can respond.
I think
to the
that based on the factors set forth and under the sentencing guidelines, the findings that a judge must make with respect to a fine was not sufficiently detailed in this case. And even if you review this case on the plain error, which I respectfully, again, believe that I made the appropriate objection at the appropriate time, given the tensions of the sentencing hearing at that time, that the fine, both the fine and the sentence, were excessive.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Stroud. Ms. Cache.
Good morning, Your Honors. I'd like to start with Tandy McElwee's argument right now. Defendant was not blindsided at sentencing with no notice whatsoever that the fine was a possible issue. The government had filed a sentencing memorandum in which the government expressly requested a non-guidelines upward departure from the guidelines range and had requested a substantial fine as a punitive measure in this case. And so there was plenty of opportunity to be aware of what the government was contending, and the government supported it in its memo, a lengthy memo, and the judge made reference to that in a kind of a shorthand manner. So I believe he incorporated many of the findings that were in the government's sentencing memorandum by reference.
Did your memo mention how much money he was making?
After he was disabled and quit his office practice for 3 years, he's going to be making slightly in excess of $22,000.
That's not my question. My question is whether your sentencing memo brought that to the attention of the judge. I know it apparently was in the PSR. We don't have the PSR.
I'm not sure that it specifically brought that point. I'm just kind of scaling through this thing. Particular point, but it was in the PSR, and so it may have been referenced in. I feel certain it was referenced in there, and that was the reason why a substantial fine was requested, was because there was so much money that the defendant was going to be making on this. As far as the standard of review, I think under either standard, this sentence will withstand a reasonableness review under plain error or under simply abuse of discretion standard. Going to Wendy Criss,
Would you address that? Because basically, I had taken the briefs as attacking primarily the prison side of the sentence, and now it's sort of been converted, I guess, by passage of time to the supervised release. Is there a different consideration in analyzing the supervised release length? I mean, should we look at this issue of whether it helps her in a way to stay on the straight and narrow, or is that not pertinent to the review here?
Your Honor, I was looking only at the prison, also the prison aspect, and I have not even researched this area. And I tend to agree with you that supervised release is probably a good thing for this particular defendant in this circumstance, because she is a person, obviously, who has a difficult time managing herself and self-discipline.
Well, she's an addict. I mean, she doesn't...
Exactly.
Well, she doesn't,
I mean, those are the people we always put on supervised release because they need the support and the drug testing and the other available treatment mechanisms that are available while you're under supervision.
Right. I think it would help this particular individual. I do not see it as being so terribly punitive. I think the 21 months... That is the punitive side of it, but the supervised release is a help to get on with your life. There's a presumption of reasonableness for a sentence within the guidelines, and her sentence was definitely within the guidelines. The
supervised release. As was the supervised release.
Exactly. All within the guidelines. She did not deserve, her guidelines were properly calculated. She did not deserve any of the reductions that she thought she would deserve. The minor participant, she was clearly not a minor participant, certainly not a minimal participant. She was in the throes of the entire conspiracy. As far as her debriefing, she lied, and the government refused to include cooperation as part of her plea agreement because she had lied several times. No one wanted to call her. Certainly the government was not going to call her at trial, and she would have been a key witness had she not had this truth-telling problem.
Is your contention that she was more seriously involved than Ava?
Than Ava? No, no, Your Honor.
How can you justify that?
She was the front person. She was the one doing the writing. She was probably the one faxing the prescriptions. All of them, I believe, were involved in that. Ava kept her distance, but Ava, there was testimony at trial from at least one of the individuals of the co-defendants that when they would pick up prescriptions in Ava's name, they would give Ava the medication rather than onto Tandy, which was the assumption that Tandy was using Ava's name rather than his own to acquire the drugs. It wasn't going directly from, say, Sandra Brannon to Tandy. It was in Ava's name, and it was going to Ava. So Ava was a conduit for her husband. The jury could easily infer that. Anyone could infer that. And there are many, many prescriptions in Ava's name. The only ones that showed up on Ava's chart were those that were involved in the subpoena from the Louisiana Board of Medical Examiners, and those were the ones that were filled at QVC, I've forgotten what the pharmacy was, but those were the only five that were included in her chart. All of the others, and there are many in her name, that were written on other pharmacies at different times.
And you're saying there was testimony that those prescriptions were put in her hands when the drugs were picked up?
There is. And there are instances in which she actually picked them up. There were a number of those. They are in the government's brief, government's memorandum on the Rule 29 motion.
I saw it.
And I listed a number in the brief also in which she actually signed for, has her driver's license, so she was the person picking them up. In her name and in other people's names also on occasion. And then back to Ava. Let's see. I think we've pretty well covered Ava, unless you have some additional questions regarding her. She was actually involved in, her handwriting was identified in Conchita McElwee's completely fabricated chart. Two different witnesses identified her handwriting in those charts. Defense counsel says that she was only aware of isolated instances. The entire atmosphere in the back office seemed to be drug-related. Everyone in the back office was an addict except Ava. Ava was apparently not addicted to the drugs. She was aware of all of this going on. She dismissed Susan Hotard, I can't remember now which one, but one of the two medical assistants who were addicted, one of them was evidently having difficulties, and she requested that this person be given to Tandy because she was shaking and she was not doing her job well, and she chose the other one who was able to do her job well. Well, the reason that they couldn't do their job very well was because they were on this medication, on hydrocodone. So Ava was aware that this person had a problem with this. The atmosphere was apparently very open. that there was drug use going on among the employees in the back office, and Ava was in the back office. One thing in the brief that is mentioned, I believe twice, is that Ava only worked part-time and was rarely there. I cannot find anything in the record that indicates that she was part-time there or rarely in the office.
But, I mean, 2.5 days out of the week would be half-time, you know, anyway. It wouldn't be rare.
That's correct. It wouldn't be rare, but she would still be there, and this atmosphere was so pervasive, she was surely aware of it, and receiving the drugs that she knew were not for her, they were going to someone, and likely they were going to Tandy McElwee. If there are no further questions, I yield the balance of my time.
All right, thank you very much, Mr. Cache. Ms. Fournier, you have time for rebuttal.
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the Court. I confess that some of this argument has been a little bit confusing to me. During Wendy Criss's presentation, Wendy Criss is described as the center of this whole elaborate mess, and indeed she was. The government, in discussing Ava McElwee's case, says that she was in the throes of the entire conspiracy. That is not true. And the government didn't think it was true at sentencing because they neither moved for an upward departure nor an upward variance, which, by the way, in this case was 6 times the guidelines. 6 times the guidelines range. In fact, in brief, I think on page 70, the government claims, in responding to Wendy Criss's arguments regarding whether she was a minor participant, that Criss controlled, quote, channels to the other defendants, and then goes on to say, quote, based on authorization from Tandy, which is also true, and Ava, which is decidedly not true, there is not a single word of testimony to indicate anything other than that Dr. McElwee gave all the nurses in the office, there were faux nurses for the most part, blanket authority to order these prescriptions. He did not give Ava McElwee that authority, and she had no authority. The person who drove this entire enterprise was Wendy Criss. And yet,
as a nurse practitioner, she can't write prescriptions.
That's true, but neither could these nurses.
No,
I mean,
no,
what
my
he
question
did,
is, can a nurse practitioner write prescriptions?
She can write prescriptions for non-controlled dangerous substances, but she cannot write prescriptions for controlled dangerous substances. But neither could Wendy Criss. And when Dr. McElwee elected to give authority to the, quote, nurses to fax and call in these prescriptions, these CDS prescriptions, he didn't give that authority to Ava. He gave it to Wendy Criss.
What is the evidence of the authorization? I mean, what if I wanted to look at the record to see who he authorized to do what? What would I look for?
Look at his testimony.
So, but there's no document saying you, and you can sign prescriptions.
No, but there was also no testimony from any government witness, and you have to think that if it was there, it would have been presented that prescriptions were called in by Ava McElwee or faxed in by Ava McElwee for these fictitious people. Not a word of testimony.
Did she do them for herself?
There's no evidence that she did them for herself. There's absolutely, and it was mentioned in my original argument, well, you know, maybe you would rank the Wendy Criss differently from Ava McElwee. Look, this is not an issue of credibility. This is an issue of the record.
Yeah, but I mean, we have cases all the time where the person who accepts responsibility gets a lesser sentence than the person who doesn't, even if that person might have also had an important role in the offense. I mean, that's just kind of how that works. You take your risk going to trial. You're certainly entitled to go to trial, but it's a risk you take.
But what the judge said was essentially that Ava McElwee was more culpable than Wendy Criss. That's the rub here. And look, read the record. There's just no other interpretation that makes any sense. The notion that somehow, regardless of what you think Ava McElwee did or didn't do, the notion that somehow she was more culpable than this Queen Bee, who basically drove everything and then apparently lied in her debriefings, was less culpable than this lady is simply completely implausible. And that is the
did
main...
Did she have supervisory authority over these nurses? Ava, did she have supervisory authority over these quasi-nurses?
Dr. McElwee testified that he had the sole hiring and firing authority and that Ava did not have that authority.
Well, that's
and there's nothing
from,
to contradict that.
But that's different from day-to-day supervision. I mean, a nurse practitioner is higher in the food chain in a regular medical office than the other people in the office.
Well, but right? you're assuming that she even knew this stuff was going on. What's to supervise when you don't know that your husband and Wendy Criss are ordering large amounts of hydrocodone over the internet and hiding the bottle in the office?
But there are all these prescriptions that she's picking up that are in her name. I mean, we're talking about inferences that can be drawn from evidence at a stage where you don't have the advantage on that. The advantage is on the other side.
I realize that. I realize that. But still, Judge, because the case law says that the more significant the variance, the more closely you have to scrutinize the sentence. And this sentence is totally out of line, and it's based on assumptions and perceptions by the judge that are totally unsupported by the record.
Okay. Thank you, Ms. Fornax.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Mr. Harville.
Thank you, Your Honor. Your Honors, this case involved three levels of participants. The McElwees, who were clearly a top level, Mrs. Criss, who is in the middle, and others, including Mrs. Cockrell and Ms. Randall, perhaps, who are minimal. This is a case that deserves a reduced sentence for Ms. Criss, especially under the factors for sentencing in what, 3553, supervised release, which Your Honor addressed. That has very serious restrictions on a defendant's life, and it has a very substantial potential effect. She has 3 years of supervised release.
I mean, I think that's good, perhaps, for an addict, as she is. I mean, she wasn't able to control herself in this office, and she was highly addicted to these drugs. She says she's clean now, and, you know, we hope the best for her, really, but we know that addicts say they're clean and then have difficulty. So, I mean, I guess I'm questioning the benefit of reducing her supervised release.
I think Your Honor has an extremely valid point, and I think there's a way that can be met in the middle ground here that can be fair to all parties. That's a reduction in the supervised release. If you don't feel that cutting her completely loose would go, a one-year period of supervised release, an 18-month period of supervised release would meet the time periods for a lot of, if not most, inpatient drug treatments. This would allow Mrs. Criss to go to a probation officer, have drug screenings, be placed in
the program. But your argument was her sentence was unreasonable in toto. And it seems to me that the supervised release is a tail wagging the dog. I mean, you didn't argue that, you know, we're here because the supervised release is too right. long. You said her overall sentence is too long, and that's just a component of the sentence. I mean, I just think this has gotten adrift to be focusing on supervised release. Unless you can show that overall sentence is unreasonable, I don't see how the supervised release even figures into it.
Well, I agree, Your Honor. And what I'm arguing, the overall sentence was unreasonable for the reasons that I've argued. Unfortunately, with the time constraints that the court has, you obviously can't go back and say, take those 3 months back or take 4 months back or whatever the court feels was appropriate to give her a reasonable sentence.
And I went and looked, and the time was spent largely in the briefing stage and not sitting in our court, because I got concerned about that. I thought, well, how did this take so long? And it really was the briefing. It wasn't really submitted to the court until a few months ago. So
that's correct. Yes, Your Honor. And this is,
I mean, I'm not blaming anyone. I just didn't want the record to reflect a tardiness on our part.
Right. And I was not inferring that. I mean, if Your Honors look at this case, this is a case that all of the attorneys, I think, have handled admirably and briefed immensely. The government's brief was 90-something pages. There's a lot of briefing which took the time. That, unfortunately, is just a matter of a complex case, an 88-count indictment, multiple counts of conviction, that it's taken this long. If Your Honors agree with me, which I think you should, that the sentence was unreasonable, that is what I'm arguing. And now we're just looking at a way to fix it. And I think a just way to fix that would be shortening the supervised release. It would still address Your Honor's concerns, give her a chance to reintegrate into society, but not give her that huge hammer which she's facing, which if she violates supervised release, she can get 3 years in prison, end up serving more time in jail than who the court's found to be the most culpable.
You're talking on our time now.
Sorry. Thank you, Your Honor.
That's all right. Mr. Stroud?
I believe, given the record that I had when I and the documents that I had when we went in court for sentencing, that appropriate objection was made. Number one, the cases cited by the government in brief when they said there was no objection to the sentence was specifically that. There was no objection, period. I made an objection. The fine was part of the sentence imposed, and I believe, based on the record I had, that my objection was sufficient to protect the record. The pre-sentence report in paragraph 162 talks about factors that may warrant departure, and in paragraph 163 talks about factors that may warrant a sentence outside of the advisory system. And in both those paragraphs, the probation officer said that they could not identify any factors that would warrant a variance, either an upward departure or a non-guideline sentence. That came up for the first time in sentencing when Judge Hicks imposed a fine of $500,000, which, as I mentioned previously, exceeded the suggested guideline range, which was $75,000, I believe, seven times. He did not consider, he made no finding on the record of ability to pay. In researching this matter of fine, I ran across cases that were cited in brief that the normal rule is, or the rule that many courts follow, is two times the amount of the restitution. In this case, restitution was $235.41.
Where'd you find that rule? Because I've been a district judge for 17 years and I never heard of it.
I cited in brief there was two and a half times the two cases I cited. They didn't say, they said that's the norm. It was not a Fifth Circuit case, but I did cite two cases in brief. There was a case that the government cited in their argument that a fine of, I think, of $500,000 was appropriate when the loss generated was over $1 million, but the loss was generated by illegal conduct. In that particular case, It was a drug operation. In this particular case, given all the assets that the government had, all the investigation, at the end of the day, the amount of restitution was $235.51. Now, I'm not suggesting that a fine over two and a half, just limited to two and a half times a restitution amount, is automatically unreasonable. I mean, that's an absurd argument. But I'm saying that if you have amount of restitution in the amount of $235.41, then something should raise a flag when the fine is $500,000. What facts were there to justify that fine at the time we appeared for sentencing? My time's completed. Thank you, Judge.
Thank you, Mr. Stroud. Mr. Harville, I think you are court-appointed, and the court would like to express its appreciation to you for your services. You've done a fine job for your client, and you've represented the court well. We appreciate that.
Thank you, Judge.
Call the next case of the day.